Cassette 1, Side 2. People were still coming up the slopes of Pavonis to the summit, filling up Sheffield, East Pavonis, Last Flow, and the other rim tents. Among them were Michelle, Spencer, Vlad, Marina, and Ursula. Mikhail and a whole brigade of Bogdanovists, Coyote on his own, a group from Praxis, a large train of Swiss, rover caravans of Arabs, both Sufi and secular, natives from other towns and settlements on Mars, all coming up for the end game. Everywhere else on Mars, the natives had consolidated their control. All the physical plants were being operated by local teams in cooperation with Séparation de l'Atmosphère. There were some small pockets of Medinat resistance, of course, and there were some Kakazi out there systematically destroying terraforming projects, but Pavonis was clearly the crux of the remaining problem. Either the endgame of the revolution, or, as Anne was beginning to fear, the opening moves of a civil war. Or both. It wouldn't be the first time. So she went to the meetings and slept poorly at night, waking from troubled sleep or from naps in the transit between one meeting and the next. The meetings were beginning to blur, all contentious, all pointless. She was getting tired, and the broken sleep didn't help. She was nearly 150 years old, after all, and hadn't had a gerontological treatment in 25 years, and she felt weary all through, all the time. So she watched from a well of growing indifference as the others chewed over the situation. Earth was still in disarray. The great flood caused by the collapse of the West Antarctic ice sheet was indeed proving to be the ideal trigger mechanism for which General Sachs had waited. Sachs felt no remorse for taking advantage of Earth's trouble, Anne could see. He never thought once about the many deaths the flood had caused down there. She could read his face thought by thought as he talked about it. What would be the point of remorse? The flood was an accident, a geological catastrophe like an ice age or a meteor impact. No one should waste time feeling remorse for it, not even if they were taking advantage of it for their own purposes. Best to take what good one possibly could from the chaos and disorder and not worry. All this was right on Sachs's face as he discussed what they should do next vis-a-vis Earth. Send a delegation, he suggested. Diplomatic mission, personal appearance, something about throwing things together. Incoherent on the surface. But she could read him like a brother, this old enemy. Well, Sachs, the old Sachs anyway, was nothing if not rational. Therefore, easy to read. Easier than the young fanatics of the Kakazi, now that she thought of it. And one could only meet him on his own ground, speak to him on his own terms. So she sat across from him in the meetings and tried to concentrate, even though her mind seemed to be hardening somehow, petrifying right inside her head. Round and round the arguments went. What to do on Pavonis? Pavonis Mons, Peacock Mountain. Who would ascend the Peacock Throne? There were potential shahs everywhere. Peter, Nergal, Jackie, Zake, Kasey, Maya, Nadia, Mikhail, Ariadne, the invisible Hiroko. Now someone was invoking the Dorsa Brevia Conference as the framework for discussion they should use. All very well, but without Hiroko among them, the moral center was gone. The one person in all Martian history, aside from John Boone, to whom everyone would defer. But Hiroko and John were gone, along with Arkady and Frank, who would have come in useful now, if he had been on her side, which he wouldn't have been. All gone. And they were left with anarchy. Curious how at a crowded table those absent could be more visible than those present. Hiroko, for instance. People referred to her frequently, and no doubt she was somewhere in the outback, deserting them as usual in their hour of need, pissing them out of the nest. curious, too, how the only child of their lost heroes, Kasei, the son of John and Hiroko, should be the most radical leader there, a disquieting man, even though he was on her side. There he sat, shaking his gray head at Art, a small smile twisting his mouth. He was nothing like either John or Hiroko. Well, he had some of Hiroko's arrogance, some of John's simplicity. The worst of both. And yet he was a power. He did what he wanted, and a lot of people followed him. But he wasn't like his parents had been. And Peter, sitting just two seats away from Kasei, was nothing like her or Simon. It was hard to see what blood relationships meant. Nothing, obviously. Though it did twist her heart to hear Peter speak, as he argued with Kasei and opposed the Reds at every point, making a case for some kind of interplanetary collaborationism, and never in these sessions addressing her or even looking at her. It was perhaps intended as some kind of courtesy. I will not argue with you in public, but it looked like a slight. I will not argue with you because you don't matter. He continued to argue for keeping the cable and agreed with Art about the Dorsa Brevia document, naturally, given the green majority that had existed then and persisted now. Using Dorsa Brevia as a guide would assure the cable's survival, meaning the continued presence of the United Nations Transitional Authority, and indeed some of them around Peter were talking about semi-autonomy in relation to Terra instead of independence, and Peter went along with that. It made her sick. And all without meeting her eye. It was Simon-like somehow, a kind of silence. It made her angry. We have no reason to talk about long-term plans until we have solved the cable problem, she said, interrupting him and earning a very black look indeed, as if she had broken an understanding. But there was no understanding, and why should they not argue when they had no real relationship? Nothing but biology. Art claimed that the UN was now saying that it would be willing to agree to Martian semi-autonomy as long as Mars remained in close consultation with Earth and an act of aid in Earth's crisis. Nadia said she was in communication with Derek Hastings, who was now up in New Clark. Hastings had abandoned Burrows without a bloody battle, it was true, and now she claimed he was willing to compromise. No doubt. His next retreat wouldn't be so easy, nor would it take him to a very pleasant place, for despite all the emergency action. Earth was now a world of famine, plague, looting, breakdown of the social contract which was so fragile after all. It could happen here, too. She had to remember that fragility when she got angry enough, as now, to want to tell Kasei and Dao to abandon the discussions and fire away. If she did that, it very likely would happen. A strange sensation of her own power came over her then, as she looked around the table at the anxious, angry, unhappy faces. She could tip the balance. She could knock this table right over. Speakers were taking 5-minute turns to make their case one way or the other. More were in favor of cutting the cable than Anne would have guessed, not just Reds, but representatives of cultures or movements that felt most threatened by the Metanat order, or by mass emigration from Earth, Bedouins, the Polynesians, the Dorsa Brevia locals, some of the cannier natives. Still, they were in the minority. Not a tiny minority, but a minority. Isolationist versus interactive. Yet another fracture to add to all the others rending the Martian independence movement. Jackie Boone stood up and spoke for 15 minutes in favor of keeping the cable, threatening anyone who wanted to bring it down with expulsion from Martian society. It was a disgusting performance, but popular, and afterward Peter stood and spoke in the same way, only slightly more subtle. It made Anne so angry that she stood up immediately after he had finished to argue for bringing the cable down. This got her another poisonous look from Peter, but it scarcely registered. She talked in a white heat, forgetting all about the 5-minute limit. No one tried to cut her off, and she went on, though she had no idea what she was going to say next, and no memory of what she had already said. Perhaps her subconscious had organized it all like a lawyer's brief, hopefully so. On the other hand, a part of her thought as her mouth ran on, perhaps she was just saying the word Mars over and over again, or babbling, and the audience simply humoring her, or else miraculously comprehending her in a moment of glossolalic grace, invisible flames on their heads like caps of jewels, and indeed their hair looked to Anne like spun metal, the old men's bald pates like chunks of jasper, inside which all languages dead and living were understood equally. And for a moment they appeared all caught up together with her, all inside an epiphany of red Mars, free of Earth, living on the primal planet that had been and could be again. She sat down. This time it wasn't Sax who rose to debate her, as it had been so many times before. In fact, he was cross-eyed with concentration, looking at her open-mouthed in an amazement that she couldn't interpret. They stared at each other, the two of them, eyes locked. But what he was thinking, she had no idea. She only knew she had gotten his attention at last. This time, it was Nadia who rebutted her. Nadia, her sister, arguing slowly and calmly for interaction with Earth, for intervention in the Terran situation. Despite the Great Flood, Earth's nations and metanationals were still incredibly powerful, and in some ways the crisis of the Flood had drawn them together, making them even more powerful. So Nadia spoke of the need to compromise, the need to engage, influence, transform. It was deeply contradictory, Anne thought. Because they were weak, Nadia was saying, they couldn't afford to offend, and therefore they must change all Terran social reality. But how? Anne cried. When you have no fulcrum, you can't move a world. No fulcrum, no lever, no force. It isn't just Earth, Nadia replied. There are going to be other settlements in the solar system. Mercury, Luna, the big outer moons, the asteroids. We've got to be part of all that. As the original settlement, we're the natural leader. An unbridged gravity well is just an obstruction to all that, a reduction in our ability to act, a reduction in our power. Getting in the way of progress, Anne said bitterly. Think what Arkady would have said to that. No, look, we had a chance here to make something different. That was the whole point. We still have that chance. Everything that increases the space within which we can create a new society is a good thing. Everything that reduces our space is a bad thing. Think about it. Perhaps they did, but it made no difference. Any number of elements on Earth were sending up their arguments for the cable. Arguments, threats, entreaties. They needed help down there. Any help. Art Randolph continued energetically lobbying for the cable on behalf of Praxis, which was looking to Anne like it would become the next transitional authority, metanationalism in its latest manifestation or disguise. But the natives were being slowly won over by them, intrigued by the possibility of conquering Earth, unaware of how impossible this was, incapable of imagining Earth's vastness and immobility. One could tell them and tell them, but they would never be able to imagine it. Finally, it came time for an informal vote. It was representative voting, they had decided. One vote for each of the signatory groups to the Dorsa Brevia document. One vote also to all the interested parties that had arisen since then. New settlements in the outback, new political parties, associations, labs, companies, guerrilla bands, the several red splinter groups. Before they started, some generous, naive soul even offered the first 100 a vote, and everyone there laughed at the idea that the first 100 might be able to vote the same way on anything. The generous soul, a young woman from Dorsa Brevia, then proposed that each of the first 100 be given an individual vote, but this was turned down as endangering the tenuous grasp they had on representative governance. It would have made no difference anyway. So they voted to allow the space elevator to remain standing for the time being, and in the possession of UNTA down to and including the socket without contestation. It was like King Canute deciding to declare the tide legal after all, but no one laughed except Anne. The other Reds were furious. Ownership of the socket was still being actively contested, Dow objected loudly. The neighborhood around it was vulnerable and could be taken. There was no reason to back off like this. They were only trying to sweep a problem under the rug because it was hard. But the majority were in agreement. The cable should remain. Anne felt the old urge. Escape. Tents and trains, people, the little Manhattan skyline of Sheffield against the south rim, the summit basalt all torn and flattened and paved over. There was a peace all the way around the rim, but the western side of the caldera was very nearly uninhabited. So Anne got in one of the smallest Red Rovers and drove around the rim counterclockwise just inside the peace until she came to a little meteorological station where she parked the rover and went out through its lock, moving stiffly in a walker that was much like the ones they had gone out in during the first years. She was a kilometer or two away from the rim's edge. She walked slowly east toward it, stumbling once or twice before she started to pay proper attention. The old lava on the flat expanse of the broad rim was smooth and dark in some places, rough and lighter in others. By the time she approached the edge, she was in full aerologist mode, doing a boulder ballet she could sustain all day, attuned to every knob and crack underfoot. And this was a good thing, because near the rim's drop-off, the land collapsed in a series of narrow curving ledges, the drop sometimes a step, sometimes taller than she was. And always the growing sense of empty air ahead as the far side of the caldera and the rest of the great circle became visible. And then she was climbing down onto the last ledge, a bench only some 5 meters wide with a curved back wall, shoulder high. And below her dropped the great round chasm of Pavonis. This caldera was one of the geological marvels of the solar system, a whole 45 kilometers across and a full 5 kilometers deep, and almost perfectly regular in every way, circular, flat-floored, almost vertically walled, a perfect cylinder of space cut into the volcano like a rock sampler's coring. None of the other three big calderas even approached this simplicity of form. Escrius and Olympus were complicated palimpsests of overlapping rings, while the very broad, shallow caldera of Arcia was roughly circular, but shattered in every way. Pavonis alone was a regular cylinder, the platonic ideal of a volcanic caldera. Of course, from this wonderful vantage point she now had, the horizontal stratification of the interior walls added a lot of irregular detail, rust and black and chocolate and umber bands indicating variations in the composition of the lava deposits. And some bands were harder than those above and below, so that there were many arcuate balconies lining the wall at different elevations, isolated curving benches perched on the side of the immense rock throat, most never visited. And the floor so flat. The subsidence of the volcano's magma chamber, located some 160 kilometers below the mountain, had to have been unusually consistent. It had dropped in the same place every time. Anne wondered if it had been determined yet why that had been. If the magma chamber had been younger than the other big volcanoes, or smaller, or the lava more homogeneous, probably someone had investigated the phenomenon. No doubt she could look it up on the wrist. She tapped out the code for the Journal of Aerological Studies, typed in Pavonis. Evidence of Strombolian explosive activity found in West Tharsis clasts. Radial ridges in caldera and concentric graben outside the rim suggest late subsidence of the summit. She had just crossed some of those graben. Release of juvenile volatiles into atmosphere calculated by radiometric dating of last flow mafix. She clicked off the wrist pad. She no longer kept up with all the latest areology. She hadn't for years. Even reading the abstracts would have taken far more time than she had. And, of course, a lot of areology had been badly compromised by the terraforming project. Scientists working for the Metanats had concentrated on resource exploration and evaluation, and had found signs of ancient oceans, of the early warm, wet atmosphere, possibly even of ancient life. On the other hand, radical red scientists had warned of increased seismic activity, rapid subsidence, mass wasting, and the disappearance of even a single surface sample left in its primal condition. Political stress had skewed nearly everything written about Mars in the past 100 years. The Journal was the only publication Anne knew of which tried to publish papers delimiting their inquiries very strictly to reporting areology in the pure sense, concentrating on what had happened in the 5 billion years of solitude. It was the only publication Anne still read, or at least glanced at, looking through the titles and some of the abstracts and the editorial material at the front. Once or twice she had even sent in a letter concerning some detail or other which they had printed without fanfare. Published by the university in Sabashi, the journal was peer-reviewed by like-minded areologists, and the articles were rigorous, well-researched, and with no obvious political point to their conclusions. They were simply science. The journal's editorials advocated what had to be called a red position, but only in the most limited sense, in that they argued for the preservation of the primal landscape so that studies could be carried on without having to deal with gross contaminations. This had been Anne's position from the very start, and it was still where she felt most comfortable. She had moved from that scientific position into political activism only because it had been forced on her by the situation. This was true for a lot of areologists now supporting the Reds. They were her natural peer group, really, the people she understood and with whom she sympathized. But they were few. She could almost name them individually. The regular contributors to the journal, more or less. As for the rest of the Reds, the Kakazi and the other radicals, what they advocated was a kind of metaphysical position, a cult. They were religious fanatics, the equivalent of Hiroko's Greens, members of some kind of rock-worshipping sect. Anne had very little in common with them when it came down to it. They formulated their redness from a completely different worldview. And given that there was that kind of fractionization among the Reds themselves, what then could one say about the Martian independence movement as a whole? Well, they were going to fall out. It was happening already. Anne sat down carefully on the edge of the final bench. A good view. It appeared there was a station of some kind down there on the caldera floor, though from 5,000 meters up it was hard to be sure. Even the ruins of old Sheffield were scarcely visible. Ah, there they were, on the floor under the new town, a tiny pile of rubble with some straight lines and plane surfaces in it. Faint vertical scorings on the wall above might have been caused by fall of the city in 61, it was hard to say. The tented settlements still on the rim were like toy villages in paperweights. Sheffield with its skyline, the low warehouses across from her to the east, last flow, the various smaller tents all around the rim. Many of them had merged to become a kind of greater Sheffield, covering almost 180 degrees of the rim, from last flow around to the southwest where Peasts followed the fallen cable down the long slope of West Tharsis to Amazonas Planitia. All the towns and stations would always be tented, because at 27 kilometers high, the air would always be a tenth as thick as it was at the datum, or sea level, one could now call it. Meaning the atmosphere up here was still only 30 or 40 millibars thick. Tent cities forever. But with the cable, she couldn't see it, spearing Sheffield, development would certainly continue until they had built a tent city entirely ringing the caldera, looking down into it. No doubt they would then tent the caldera itself and occupy the round floor, add about 1,500 square kilometers to the city, though it was a question who would want to live at the bottom of such a hole, like living at the bottom of a mohole, rock walls rising up around you as if you were in some circular, roofless cathedral. Perhaps it would appeal to some. The Bogdanovists had lived in moholes for years, after all. Grow forests, build climbers' huts or other millionaires' penthouses on the arcuate balcony ledges, cut staircases into the sides of the rock, install glass elevators that took all day to go up or down, rooftops, row houses, skyscrapers reaching up toward the rim, heliports on their flat round roofs, pistes, flying freeways. Oh yes, the whole summit of Pavonis Mons, caldera and all, could be covered by the great world city, which was always growing, growing like a fungus over every rock in the solar system. Billions of people, trillions of people, quadrillions of people, all as close to immortal as they could make themselves. She shook her head in a great confusion of spirits. The radicals in Last Flow were not her people. Not really. But unless they succeeded, the summit of Pavonis and everywhere else on Mars would become part of the great world city. She tried to concentrate on the view. She tried to feel it, the awe of the symmetrical formation, the love of rock hard under her bottom. Her feet hung over the edge of the bench. She kicked her heels against basalt. She could throw a pebble, and it would fall 5,000 meters. But she couldn't concentrate. She couldn't feel it. Petrification. So numb for so long. She sniffed, shook her head, pulled her feet in over the edge, walked back up to her rover. She dreamed of the long run out. The landslide was rolling across the floor of Mellus Chasma, about to strike her. Everything visible with surreal clarity. Again she remembered Simon. Again she groaned and got off the little dike, going through the motions, appeasing a dead man inside her, feeling awful. The ground was vibrating. She woke, by her own volition, she thought, escaping, running away. But there was a hand pulling hard on her arm. Anne! 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 It was Nadia. Another surprise. Anne struggled up, disoriented. Where are we? Pavonis, Anne. The revolution. I came over and woke you because a fight has broken out between Cassé's Reds and the Greens in Sheffield. The present rolled over her like the landslide in her dream. She jerked out of Nadia's grasp, groped for her shirt. Wasn't my rover locked? I broke in. Ah. Anne stood up, still foggy, getting more annoyed the more she understood the situation. Now what happened? They launched missiles at the cable. They did. Another jolt, further clearing away the fog. And? It didn't work. The cable's defense systems shot them down. They've got a lot of hardware up there now, and they're happy to be able to use it at last. But now the Reds are moving into Sheffield from the west, firing more rockets, and the UN forces on Clark are bombing the first launch sites over on Ascrius, and they're threatening to bomb every armed force down here. This is just what they wanted. And the Reds think it's going to be like Burrows, obviously. They're trying to force the action. So I came to you. Look, Anne, I know we've been fighting a lot. I haven't been very, you know, patient, but look, this is just too much. Everything could fall apart at the last minute. The UN could decide the situation here is anarchy and come up from Earth and try to take over again. Where are they? Anne croaked. She pulled on pants, went to the bathroom. Nadia followed her right in. This, too, was a surprise. In Underhill, it might have been normal between them, but it had been a long, long time since Nadia had followed her into a bathroom talking obsessively while Anne washed her face and sat down and peed. They're still based in Last Flow. But now they've cut the rim pieced and the one to Cairo, and they're fighting in West Sheffield and around the socket. Reds fighting greens. Yes, yes. So will you talk to the Reds? Will you stop them? A sudden fury swept through Anne. You drove them to this, she shouted in Nadia's face, causing Nadia to crash back into the door. Anne got up and took a step toward Nadia and yanked her pants up, shouting still. You and your smug, stupid terraforming, it's all green, 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 and never a hint of compromise. It's just as much your fault as theirs, since they have no hope. Maybe so, Nadia said mulishly. Clearly she didn't care about that. It was the past and didn't matter. She waved it aside and wouldn't be swerved from her point. But will you try? Anne stared at her stubborn old friend, at this moment almost youthful with fear, utterly focused and alive. I'll do what I can, Anne said grimly. But from what you say, it's already too late. It was indeed too late. The rover camp Anne had been staying in was deserted, and when she got on the wrist and called around, she got no answers. So she left Nadia and the rest of them stewing in the East Pavonis warehouse complex and drove her rover around to Last Flow, hoping to find some of the Red leaders based there. But Last Flow had been abandoned by the Reds, and none of the locals knew where they had gone. People were watching TVs in the stations and cafe windows, but when Anne looked too, she saw no news of the fighting, not even on Mangalavid. A feeling of desperation began to seep into her grim mood. She wanted to do something, but she didn't know how. She tried her wrist pad again, and to her surprise, Cassay answered on their private band. His face in the little image looked shockingly like John Boone's, so much so that in her confusion, Anne didn't at first hear what he said. He looked so happy. It was John to the life. Had to do it, he was telling her. Anne wondered if she had asked him about that. If we don't do something, they'll tear this world apart. They'll garden it right up to the tops of the Big Four. This echoed Anne's thoughts on the ledge enough to shock her again, but she collected herself and said, We've got to work within the framework of the discussions, Cassay, or else we'll start a civil war. We're a minority, Anne. The framework doesn't care about minorities. I'm not so sure. That's what we have to work on. And even if we do decide on active resistance, it doesn't have to be here and now. It doesn't have to be Martians killing Martians. They're not Martian. There was a glint in his eye. His expression was Hiroko-like in its distance from the ordinary world. In that sense, he was not like John at all. The worst of both parents. And so they had another prophet speaking a new language. Where are you now? West Sheffield. What are you going to do? Take the socket and then bring down the cable. We're the ones with the weapons and the experience. I don't think we'll have much trouble. You didn't bring it down first try. Too fancy. We'll just chop it down this time. I thought that wasn't the way to do it. It'll work. Cassay, I think we need to negotiate with the Greens. He shook his head, impatient with her, disgusted that she had lost her nerve when push came to shove. After the cable is down, we'll negotiate. Look, Anne, I've got to go. Stay out of the fall line. Cassay! But he was gone. No one listened to her. Not her enemies, not her friends, not her family. Though she would have to call Peter. She would have to try Cassay again. She needed to be there in person, to get his attention as she had Nadia's. Yes, it had come to that. To get their attention, she had to shout right in their faces. The possibility of getting blocked around East Pavonis kept her going west from Last Flow, circling counterclockwise as she had the day before, to come on the Red Force from its rear, no doubt the best approach anyway. It was about a 150-kilometer drive from Last Flow to the western edge of Sheffield, and as she sped around the summit, just outside the Peast, she spent the time trying to call the various forces on the mountain with no success. Explosive static marked the fight for Sheffield, and memories of 61 erupted with these brutal bursts of white noise, frightening her. She drove the rover as fast as it would go, keeping it on the Peast's narrow outside apron to make the ride smoother and faster, 100 kilometers per hour, then faster, racing, really, to try to stave off the disaster of a civil war. There was a terrible, dreamlike quality to it, and especially in that it was too late. Too late. In moments like these, she was always too late. In the sky over the caldera, starred clouds appeared instantaneously, explosions, without a doubt, missiles fired at the cable and shot down in mid-flight, in white puffs, like incompetent fireworks, clustered over Sheffield and peaking in the region of the cable, but puffing into existence all over the vast summit, then drifting off east on the jet stream. Some of those rockets were getting nailed a long way from their target. Looking up at the battle overhead, she almost drove into the first tent of West Sheffield, which was already punctured. As the town had grown westward, new tents had attached to the previous ones like lobes of pillow lava. Now the construction moraines outside the latest tent were littered with bits of framework like shards of glass, and the tent fabric was missing in the remaining soccer ball shapes. Her rover bounced wildly over a mound of basalt rubble. She braked, drove slowly up to the wall. The vehicle locked doors were stuck shut. She put on her suit and helmet, ducked into the rover's own lock, left the car. Heart pounding hard, she walked up to the city wall and climbed over it into Sheffield. The streets were deserted. Glass and bricks and bamboo shards and twisted magnesium beams lay scattered on the street grass. At this elevation, tent failure caused flawed buildings to pop like balloons. Windows gaped empty and dark, and here and there complete rectangles of unbroken windows lay scattered like great clear shields. And there was a body, face frosted or dusted. There would be a lot of dead. People weren't used to thinking about decompression anymore. It was an old settler's worry, but not today. Anne kept walking east. "Look for Cassay or Dow or Marion or Peter," she said to her wrist again and again. But no one replied. She followed a narrow street just inside the southern wall of the tent. Harsh sunlight, sharp-edged black shadows. Some buildings had held, their windows in place, their lights on inside. No one to be seen in them, of course. Ahead, the cable was just visible, a black vertical stroke rising into the sky out of East Sheffield, like a geometric line become visible in their reality. The red emergency band was a signal transmitted in a rapidly varying wavelength, synchronized for everyone who had the current encryption. This system cut through some kinds of radio jamming very well. Nevertheless, Anne was surprised when a crow voice cawed from her wrist. "Anne, it's Dow, up here." He was actually in sight, waving at her from a doorway into a building's little emergency lock. He and a group of some 20 people were working with a trio of mobile rocket launchers out in the street. Anne ran over to them, ducked into the doorway beside Dow. "This has to stop," she cried. Dow looked surprised. "We've almost got the socket." "But what then? Talk to Cassay about that. He's up ahead going for Arcee of you." One of their rockets whooshed away, its noise faint in the thin air. Dow was back at it. Anne ran forward up the street, keeping as close as she could to the building siding it. It was obviously dangerous, but at that moment she didn't care if she was killed or not, so she had no fear. Peter was somewhere in Sheffield, in command of the Green Revolutionaries who had been there from the beginning. These people had been efficient enough to keep the UNTA security forces trapped on the cable and up on Clark, so they were by no means the hapless, pacifistic young native street demonstrators that Cassay and Dow seemed to have assumed they were. Her spiritual children, mounting an attack on her only actual child in complete confidence that they had her blessing, as once they had. But now, she struggled to keep running, her breath hard and ragged, the sweat beginning to flood through all over her skin. She hurried to the south tent wall, where she came on a little fleet of red boulder cars, Turtle Rocks, from the Acheron car manufactory. But no one inside them answered her calls, and when she looked closer, she saw that their rock roofs were punctured by holes at their fronts, where the windshields would have been underneath the rock overhang. Anyone inside them was dead. She ran on eastward, staying against the tent wall, heedless of debris underfoot, feeling a rising panic. She was aware that a single shot from anyone could kill her, but she had to find Kasey. She tried again over the wrist. While she was at it, a call came into her. It was Sax. "It isn't logical to connect the fate of the elevator with terraforming goals," he was saying, as if he was speaking to more people than just her. "The cable could be tethered to quite a cold planet." It was the usual Sax, the all-too Sax. But then he must have noticed she was on, because he stared owlishly into his wrist's little camera and said, "Listen, Anne, we can take history by the arm and break it. Make it. Make it new." Her old Sax would never have said that, nor chattered on at her, clearly distraught, pleading, visibly nerve-wracked. One of the most frightening sights she had ever seen, actually. "They love you, Anne. It's that that can save us. Emotional histories are the true histories. Watersheds of desire and devolution, devotion. You're the personification of certain values for the natives. You can't escape that. You have to act with that. I did it in Da Vinci, and it proved helpful. Now it's your turn. You must. You must. Anne, just this once, you must join us all. Hang together or hang separately. Use your iconic value."
This ends side two of cassette one of Blue Mars. Please fast forward to the end before loading cassette two.